Welcome once again to our program, Reasons to Believe. Are Catholic Apologetics or Fundamental Theology? I'm talking with my guest, as usual, Ron Eldred, who teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, history, world history, American history, and a good deal of church history. And I'm your host, Monsignor Larry Moran, pastor emeritus for 20 years at St. Patrick's and the present chaplain of John Paul II Catholic High. Ron, welcome once again. And we've come in our series to the 20th series where we're talking about what we can know from reason itself without the help of the Ten Commandments or revelation of the Bible, that the duties we owe to God. We talked about how we come to know the existence of God. Now, how about the duties that we owe to God?
And we also looked at his attributes as well.
Attributes.
We can know his perfections and things of that sort without revelation.
Okay.
And now we'll go on and, as you asked the question there, deal with the duties. We can know a lot of the things that we owe God just simply by using our reason, again, without revelation. And some of the things is we can know that we should worship God. Since God is the supreme being, we must acknowledge him as such, and this acknowledgement is called worship. This flows from some of the attributes that we discussed in our earlier session.
And even pagan philosophers reasoned to this, and the great civilizations, even pagan civilizations, came to that we must and somehow worship the creator, the divine designer of all things, even though they came into some kind of strange worships.
Yeah, you look at all the dozens or the hundreds of religions around the world over the history of the world, and maybe even thousands, and they didn't have revelation, divine revelation, and yet they still saw a need to worship God in many different ways, but nonetheless to worship God. And also gratitude. Probably all religions have seen the need to show God gratitude, to thank God before God is, since he's already perfect, our creation added nothing to him, and thus even our very existence is a gift from God. And so therefore we owe him gratitude.
Parents always teach their little kids when they go out to visit another home, now be sure and say thank you. But it's something that we need to do also, be sure and say thank you to God, that even our reason could tell us that.
And we owe God obedience. Since he created us, he obviously knows what's best for us. And you could look at some of the various attributes that we looked at earlier, and a God who's omnipotent, all-powerful, a God that knows everything, a God who's infinite, a God who's eternal. It's just a logical deduction that we should obey God who knows what's best for us, and we owe him everything.
And we can, I think, compare that to a child. As children, we have to be grateful to our parents who gave us everything, life itself. We need to obey our parents, and we need to love our parents because they love us.
Well, that's the last and the most important thing that we can know without it being revealed to us, that we should love God, or whatever our conception of God is.
Okay.
Love is a response to goodness, and since God is perfect, he is infinite goodness. Love is a response to goodness, and since God is perfect, he is infinite goodness. And so we can know that. We can know those kinds of things without God revealing these things to us.
I think, when we go through an art museum, and we have a good art museum here in town, but you hear people saying, oh, isn't that a magnificent painting? Isn't that a magnificent sculpture? Well, we're giving credit where credit is due. And so the same thing, we give credit where credit is due to God, and gratitude and obedience and love.
I'll just conclude this little discussion of what we owe God. Up to a point, we can know the existence and perfections of God through natural reason, as we've said. and our obligations to Him are logical conclusions from our knowledge of God and His perfections. In other words, we can know all these duties that we owe God because of His perfections, because of His qualities, because of His attributes. Therefore, we don't need the teachings of the church to know these duties. He obviously knows what's best for us. St. Paul, in several places, if I recall right, speaks of the pagans, you know. They should have known better, that they could look at nature and they could see, and they had reason, they had the ability. And a lot of them did. You know, you take some of the great philosophers went a long way, the great philosophers, in getting to the right answers, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle. And that's why the church, the fathers of the church, picked up on these Greek philosophers and used their methodologies. For example, Augustine uses Plato's way, and later on, St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, picks up and uses a lot of the methodology of Aristotle, because there was a lot of truth in it, that they had gone a long way just using natural reason to understand God. They had a long way to go, but they still went a long way, as far as any other human beings had ever gone without revelation.
Well, one of the reasons we're talking about this is not that we're trying to in any way downplay revelation.
That's correct.
We're just saying that if a person doesn't even accept the Bible or know about revelation, there's still an awful lot that I can know by reason alone. And so, as Paul says, there's no excuse for the pagans in his letter to the Romans not accepting the wonder and the mystery and the awesomeness of God. Okay, well, I think this leads us to the next very important part about the immortality of the soul. First of all, that a soul does exist, and a spiritual soul exists in our material body, and that this soul is immortal, undying. That the philosophers have come to a conclusion of that even from reason alone. So let's talk about that. Is it reasonable to believe that as a human being I possess an immortal, undying part of me, spirit?
I think this is certainly true. Among the most important philosophical problems is the question of the reality of the soul and its distinction from the body. In the class I teach in apologetics at John Paul II Catholic High, we spend probably a good couple of sessions just dealing with this, two or three sessions, just dealing with this problem of the soul, proving it, that it's reasonable to believe that there is a soul. In the modern world, with the skepticism and that's so prevalent, quite often there are people who believe that the soul is nothing more than a function of the body and of the brain. And when a person dies, then of course the soul just deteriorates. But what we're going to be looking at is the idea that the soul is immortal, and trying to prove that. Now, we won't be able to go into as detailed a proof as we do in my class, where we actually use syllogisms and things like that to the method that St. Thomas Aquinas and other people use to prove these things from a logical, rational point of view. But we'll try to give at least the essence of the idea anyway.
So that we are composed of body material and soul immaterial, our spirit.
Yes, so again, as I just said, the one of the most important philosophical questions, and probably theological as well, is the question of the reality of the soul and its distinction from the body. And this is true because it is bound up with the doctrine of the immortality of the soul. And the answer to this question is extremely important to us because some have claimed, as I said a while ago, that the soul is just nothing but a function of the body, especially of the brain, and that when the body dies, the soul dies. The Catholic Encyclopedia defines the human soul as, quote, the ultimate internal principle by which we think, feel, and will, and by which our bodies are animated. This definition implies that the soul is not dependent on the body for its existence. And if there be life after death, clearly the soul must be capable of an existence separate from the body. What they're talking about here in this definition is that the church has always said, and this goes back to Greek philosophy that the soul forms the body. It gives it life. And then the soul has faculties. And again, the ancient Greek philosophers dealt with these faculties of intellect and will and imagination and memory, things of that sort. And the Catholic Church has picked up that philosophy because it's true. And as I said, even using their reason, these philosophers were able to go a long way in describing things as they really are in such spiritual matters.
I've often thought of an imperfect image. They say every image limps, or it's not perfect. But like a man stepping out of a suit of armor, the armor is completely inanimate once the person has left the suit of armor and gone someplace else in another room of the castle. So once our soul leaves our body is completely non-living, but the soul goes on to another room, as Jesus called it. There are many mansions in my Father's house if we've lived and followed him. Well, your definition of soul, Ron, applies only to human beings, but isn't it true that we say every living thing, a plant, an animal, has a soul?
Yes, Aristotle, back in the 4th century B.C., dealt with this issue. St. Thomas Aquinas certainly picked up on it in the 13th century and developed it and Christianized it, you might say. So this is certainly true. All living things have souls. Depends on how you define soul. In this particular case, souls, we're looking at that aspect of the definition, which the idea that souls form bodies and it gives them life. Whether they be simple one-celled organisms or complex rational beings such as we are. The most obvious differences, though, between the living and non-living things is that non-living things can't act themselves. They can only be acted upon. For example, rocks can't roll down hills by themselves. They must be moved either by being thrown or pushed, or acted on by gravity. On the other hand, living things are beings, even so-called, or even one-cell plant life, have the capacity to act on their own power. And things that have the ability to act upon their own power have souls. They're living. They have life in them if they can act on their own power. In other words, they can perform, looking at it from a philosophical point of view, immanent acts. In this case, immanent simply means the organism has the power to act within itself. That's all it means when we say immanent acts.
So we call it a material soul for a vegetable, a carrot.
That's sentient, yes. Or an animal soul.
For a cat would be an animal soul. Okay.
Keeping in mind, soul means that which forms and gives life. Okay. To any living thing.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about that because I think, again, those distinctions always help us to clarify what the Church teaches, even on a natural level. So you're saying any living being, like a tree or a lion or a human being, has to have some unifying principle to make its actions possible?
Yes. We call the substantial form of a living thing or being its soul. So, you have animal souls, and you have vegetable souls, and you have human souls. But there's a difference. There's a qualitative difference, of course, between them. They're not just differences of degree, but they're differences of quality, which we'll stress here in just a minute. But scholastic philosophers such as St. Thomas Aquinas, he spoke of these three types. He picked this up from Aristotle, the vegetative, the animal, and the human soul. Plants have vegetative souls, animals have animative or animal souls, and humans have spiritual or rational souls. That's the difference between the human being and the plant or the animal, is that the human soul is spiritual.
Okay, and immortal.
Immortal, yes.
We wouldn't say, or undying. We wouldn't say a vegetative or a animal soul is immortal.
In other words, when the plant or the animal dies, the soul dies with it. When a human being dies, the soul separates from the body and will continue to exist until the end of time, until it's reunited with a glorified body, if they're going to heaven at the end of time.
Now, the philosophers came to that by reason alone.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk a moment about vegetative or a plant soul.
Vegetative souls do not exist independently of the plants, like a human soul, of course, can, and cease to exist when the plant dies. In scholastic terms, the plant soul is the formal cause of the matter, making it the kind of living thing that it is, making it alive and able to do living acts. The vegetative soul gives a plant the power to perform immanent acts such as growth, nourishment, and reproduction. And we mean by immanent acts those which were within the power of the organism itself.
Okay.
And death causes a substantial change in plants, in which the matter remains the same, but it takes on a new form. That is, it becomes something else, breaking down into its constitutive parts as it decays, or elements, and dies, of course. Its soul does not continue after the plant dies, but dies with the plant.
Okay. So we talk about the last rose of summer. Once it dies, it completely disintegrates, and there is no soul of a rose that lives on. Okay, let's talk about an animal soul.
Well, animals have animative souls, or animal souls, and animals not only have the power to grow, be nourished, and reproduce, as do plants, but in addition, they have senses and motion. In other words, animals have both vegetative and animative powers. And by using their senses, animals can associate things with pleasure and pain and store these associations in the memory of their brains. Consequently, animals can be trained because they can remember. And everything animals learn must be associated with some material thing they perceive through their senses. In other words, animals can't reason. At least what little reasoning power they might have is certainly very limited.
Okay.
For more intelligent animals, such as chimpanzees and porpoises, they learn by associating things with pleasure or pain, rewards or punishments. For example, some researchers have claimed that they have taught chimpanzees how to read, or some other amazing feat that only humans can perform. And this has led them to claim that there are essentially no differences between them and humans, that the differences are only matters of degree and not of kind. But certainly, there are cases where humans have trained animals, but have we ever heard of cases where animals have trained humans?
Okay.
Or have we ever heard of cases where if an animal itself has not been trained and learned to make these associations which are stored in its brain, have the ability to train its own young? It has to be taught itself first.
Okay.
More humans write books about monkeys, but you don't see it the other way around. And it is true that humans do have some things in common with animals, such as having material bodies and sensory knowledge and some instincts. But nonetheless, there still exist fundamental differences between animals and humans. And these differences are of kind and not simply of degree. And the reason this is important is because there are many people claiming there is no difference, that they're just a matter of degree between an ape and a human being.
And that's where you get into some of these arguments about, can you use animals for medicinal experimentation? Because animals have rights.
Oh, yeah.
Just like human
beings. Some people give animals rights than they do human beings.
Yeah, and there's where clear thinking again, the church has always justified experiments on animals, mice or whatever it might be, to learn important things for human health and human and scientific advancement.
And that should be done, of course, in a humane way.
Sure, in a humane way. Sacrificing the life of a mouse or a chimpanzee or a monkey to learn important scientific knowledge is really different than experimenting on human beings, as Dr. Mengele did in the terrible concentration camp area of the Nazi Third Reich, because they were treating human beings like animals.
The term humane applies to human beings being human and acting in a human way, not to the animals themselves, as a lot of times it's associated with.
And I think the distinction the church would make is that we have an obligation to always treat animals as an intelligent being, not to cause unnecessary suffering, not to in any way use the animals, to abuse the animals, or anything like that.
Yeah, humane just simply means we treat animals in a human way.
Yeah.
The human way to treat them is, you know, with concern.
Regard. They're part of God's creation.
Right.
But not that they would have the same rights as human beings. Okay. Can we talk a little about the human soul rather than the plant soul or the tree soul or the cat or the dog or the lion soul, the animal soul?
Humans have not only have the power to grow, to be nourished, and to reproduce. They also have senses and motions, but in addition, they have spiritual or rational powers. In other words, humans have vegetative, animative, and rational powers. They have all three. The basic differences between humans and animals is that the substantial form of the human soul is spiritual, not material. Material things are concrete, whereas spiritual things are neither composed of nor dependent upon matter. However, to be spiritual means more than to be not composed of matter or immaterial. For instance, although our senses are immaterial, they depend on matter. We cannot have senses without the material organs that, you know, to smell or taste or hear or feel or see.
One of the greatest gifts that God has given us is our five senses. Been books written on that, the awesomeness of the five senses. You mentioned somewhere back in our series that the human eye, the complexity of the human eye, that there are books and books written about it, saying that the most complex camera is just a simple toy compared to the complexity of the human eye. And that's the way. As a gift of the senses.
Yes, our senses are a connection with the material world.
Okay, now we're going to get into a really important area here about how do we know from reason that our human soul is undying or immortal, or that we will ever live and never die with our human soul?
Yeah, to follow this argument through in its completion is a fairly complex issue, so we're not going to go into the whole thing. But one of the main Christian doctrines is that the human soul is immortal and will be reunited with its body at the end of time, at the last judgment. Short of revelation, if it can be proven that the human soul is spiritual and not material, we can prove that it is immortal, because a spiritual being is simple. It's without parts, so it can't decompose.
Okay, so how can we prove from reason alone, as the philosophers have continually done through the centuries before Christ and after Christ, that the human soul is spiritual and not material?
Well, again, short of God's revelation to prove the spirituality of the human soul, we must prove the soul is independent of matter. You see, in the case of animals and vegetables, the animal soul, the vegetative soul, is not independent of the material it's made out of. But human beings, the whole point is that our soul is of a substance or a material that's can live independent, is independent. And so what we're trying to prove is that that's true. And to do this requires a fairly complex answer, far beyond, as I said, what we can do during this series. But remember that the intellect is a major component of the soul. And all I can say about the matter now is, if we can demonstrate that the intellect is spiritual, we can prove that the soul is spiritual. since the effect cannot be greater than the cause, that's really kind of the heart of the whole issue. The effect cannot be greater than the cause. And to do this requires the use of a methodology we have not attempted to explain and to employ in this series. That is, the syllogism and that type of rational logic. But to give a hint, the answer has to do with our ability to comprehend immaterial ideas, such as universal concepts, spiritual things, such as truth and beauty and justice. If our souls were only material, it would not have the ability to understand immaterial things, as I said, such as truth and beauty and justice, to even comprehend them, which, as I said, they don't have material quality. Or we couldn't even have self-reflection. Because since the intellect, which is immaterial, can reflect upon itself, it must be spiritual. In other words, the human being has a concept of himself or herself. They can step out of themselves, so to speak, and see themselves. And that requires a spiritual being. It's beyond and above any material existence. And finally, the use of language. This is a very important one. The use of language to communicate, it's a spiritual thing. Because it's not limited to the words with which we write or speak. The point is that if it can be proven that the human soul is spiritual and not simply a function of the body or the brain, the human soul can be proven to be immortal. It can't die with the body. And if anyone should want a detailed explanation of this kind of thing, I would be happy to send it to them, a little essay or something.
Okay, so I heard one time at a funeral, the priest said, the world is divided into those who believe that the soul does not die and those who believe that the soul does die, that there is life after death or there is not life after death. And it just struck me as a pretty clear distinction of a very fundamental issue about what we're talking.
Yes, it requires a spiritual being to be able to comprehend universals. Again, there's another philosophical term, but by universals, we essentially give an example, such things as truth and beauty and justice and things of that sort. Or to use language. Language is a spiritual thing, which is not as such tied to particular words or symbols or whatever. Or to be able to step outside yourself and see, have a self-reflection, a concept of your own existence, of your own being. Those are all spiritual qualities.
Okay, let's take a little summary of what we've been saying. There on page 86, that third paragraph, because I think it tries to sum up what we're saying about the human soul being spiritual and therefore undying. Time has run out, Ron. May God bless you always and in all ways.